Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Soundbites on The Mark Steiner Show, here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. Soundbites is our weekly exploration of issues related to food, agriculture, and our environment here on The Mark Steiner Show. And this morning we learn what compelled a middle school teacher in Salisbury to write a letter to the editor in the Baltimore Sun demanding better treatment for animals like chickens on Purdue's farms. But first, we hear a story about Baltimore. You know, over the years, we have had intense conversations about the community called Curtis Bay in the Baltimore area. One of those conversations we've been having with them has been around the issue of an incinerator to be built in their community, and actually the youth movement that began around that, led by people like Destiny Watford when she was in high school, is now a student at Towson University, and she's been on the show just recently talking about that and about the efforts to stop the incinerator, starting a youth movement, involve the community. The community, again, in many ways is very divided because people are worried about jobs, and this incinerator offers jobs to some people. People want those jobs, but then it's the environmental fallout, the health effects of this, and people who want an alternative way to build their community. So we continue that conversation today, Earlier, the last few weeks, Destiny Watford spoke to the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent that we covered here on the Mark Steiner Show last week. Not her conversation, but what that report was saying to all of us. And so we're going to talk about that in the light of what's been happening and what this all means, what's behind it and under it, from the perspectives of those who do not support, I should say, lightly speaking, as half-heartedly here, the incinerator being built in Curtis Bay. We are joined by Tim Whitehouse, who is executive director of the Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's worked on environmental consultant for a major metal recycling company and a company that produces industrial hygienic products, and he's head of the law and policy program at the Commission for Environmental Cooperation in Montreal, Canada, and an attorney at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. Dr. Gwen Du Bois is with us. She is secretary of the Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility's Board of Directors, an internist practicing here in Baltimore, an instructor in medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and a member of the Public Health Committee of the Maryland State Medical Society. And Gwen and Tim, welcome. Good to have you both with us. And I was thinking about this when I remember your letter that you wrote to the editor back in November that was published in the Baltimore Sun about this incinerator. So I'm going to get to the heart of that letter in a moment because you threw out so many facts in there that I think it's important to kind of delineate those for our listeners. But can we just generally talk about, again, for listeners who may just be tuning in for the first time, what's the history of this? Who wants to jump into that? Gwen, go ahead.
All right. So Curtis Bay and the area around 21226 has been the home of a lot of toxic industry, toxic pollution. And I know I got involved around 1996, 97 when I was getting my master's in public health because the biggest medical waste incinerator in the country was located down in Hawkins Point right near Curtis Bay. And so it receives waste, medical waste, from a 240-mile radius. And, you know, the question is, why is that being brought here? Why do the people here have to deal with the emissions from that? And medical waste was notorious for mercury and dioxin pollution. So when a few years ago we found out that here was coming another huge, one of the biggest incinerators, not medical waste, but it was an incinerator that was going to be dealing with things like tires and other industry pollution, why again was it coming here and why were the people going to have to deal with this? So, but as, you know, we started finding out more about this incinerator, we also learned about a wonderful community response to it as high school students and people with the United Worker who were working with the students. There began to be a real response to this project, and people didn't want it, and they became well-informed. They learned about the environment. They learned about, you know, what was going on. So Physicians for Social Responsibility, as a physician's organization and concerned about the environment and the health effects of environmental pollution, it was something that we just got right involved in And, you know, we're able, I think, to provide some of the details about the health aspects of this that people knew, but we could do it from a point of view of, you know, the work that we did as physicians and nurses.
I'm sorry, Tim.
Well, my introduction to Curtis Bay was fairly recent, and it was through the angle of lead emissions. So lead is probably one of the most toxic and dangerous substances that particularly children can have in their system. And prior to working with Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility, I studied lead regulations in the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and I've worked for private industry on lead issues. And when I saw the Energy Answers permit, that it was permitted to emit 1,000 pounds of lead in a community, I was quite frankly shocked and began to look at what sort of monitoring systems were in Curtis Bay and what sort of systems were in the area to see what the pollution levels in the atmosphere were like. And it was very difficult to find any answers. And as we began to look into it, just recently we've asked the Maryland Department of Environment to impose a moratorium on new facilities that emit lead in southern Baltimore and Curtis Bay. And we're waiting for a response on that. But, for example, you get many facilities in the United States that are strictly regulated because they emit lead. They're much more dangerous facilities, and they emit much less lead, and they're carefully monitored. And here we have an incinerator that's given a special deal that's located in a community, and where that lead, those lead particles will probably migrate into the community, and they will not be decay or destroyed. So it's a very potentially dangerous situation, and there's very little information about the effects of these pollutants on the local communities.
So, I mean, but politically, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, this first came up under Governor Martin O'Malley's administration, right?
Yes.
And now sliding into Governor Hogan's administration. People have been protesting and standing up about this for a long time, coming up with alternatives. So, I mean, what's the – well, maybe you can speak to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been involved in this, and you were also one of those arrested, if I know.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, the Department of Environment. And we talked about that the day after it happened. But what about the political end of this?
Well, you know, it's a little confusing because – that is to say it makes no sense because it's been through two administrations, one Democrat and one Republican. And, you know, I think Energy Answers – when Governor O'Malley was governor, looked friendly upon this project. And I don't know – all the details of that, so I won't speak to that. But they were pushing it. The mayor was pushing it. And administration has changed in the governorship. And still, there seems to be support for this at the highest level. But in terms of details about why this is going on, it makes no sense. The company is from Albany, New York. The amount of energy it would provide is not big. And it's more polluting than coal in lead, particulate matter, nitrogen oxides. So it's not a good way to get energy. And yet it's been made tier one from the previous administration, means that there are tax breaks for calling this a waste energy facility. And because it's called waste for energy, it skirts some of the regulations that there are on incinerators. For example, it's located near within 1 mile of two schools. So there are a lot of reasons why it shouldn't happen, and yet we can't understand why it is going forward. Now, there are there are permits that have been already given by the Maryland Department of the Environment, but work that's been done by lawyers involved, including Environmental Integrity Project, have informed us how their permit has been violated according to EPA regulations about when you begin construction, you have to do it in a timely way, which they haven't. And this company has really just sat on that land. Very little's been done. And yet we can't get the Maryland Department of the Environment to say that the permit should be pulled. It's been violated. And we don't know why this is happening.
It's been almost 2 months since the company Energy Answers has given their letter, the response to the Department of Environment because they violated certain rules by and they didn't comply with their regulations. So they put a letter in, and that was part of the reasons you all had to sit in, was to see what happened at that letter.
Because we weren't getting a response from the Maryland Department of the Environment. And then we met with Secretary Grumbles, and he urged us to leave his office, and then he would meet with us next week. That was back – when was that? That was December, I think. And but he wouldn't promise us to give us an answer. And we were under the impression that there would be a response sometime in January. And here we are in February, and it just goes on month after month after month. They sit there on that land. The community has ideas about projects. You mentioned
well, who
jobs.
Who owns the land?
I think it's FMC. It's a chemical company.
They do own the land.
Yes. So it's a lease.
I'm sorry, you're about to say something about projects.
Okay. So, you know, people say, well, this is a source of jobs. And goodness knows, people in Curtis Bay want jobs. But there aren't jobs. They're just sitting on that land year after year after year. And meanwhile, the community that's organized against this incinerator has done some work with some NGOs that work with clean jobs. And there are some opportunities and companies that would like to come into that area and provide jobs that are cleaner, much cleaner than this facility would be with the kind of emissions they've been permitted to emit. And as Tim said, you know, one of the most egregious is 1,000 pounds of lead. And everybody's talking about Flint, which is horrible. And now people have to react to what's happened and what can be done to the children after they've been exposed. So we're saying here in Curtis Bay, don't expose these children.
Well, are there any legal remedies for this in terms of the community, like suing in the federal court through EPA regulations?
Well, I think that's probably not our bailiwick to get into the legal recourse that people have. I think there are groups looking at that.
But I guess your familiarity with the law is wondering if you think that is a recourse.
I don't know. I do know we're looking at it from the health angle and from the economics angle. And I'll add about the economics angle. If you put one of the largest incinerators in the country in Curtis Bay, what will that do long term to the property values, not only in Curtis Bay but the surrounding communities, when you have hundreds and hundreds and thousands of diesel trucks going through those communities? This is a big step backward for that community. And it's very puzzling as to why the political leadership in Baltimore has been largely silent on this issue. If a 1,000-pound if an incinerator that was permitted to emit 1,000 pounds of lead was proposed to be located near your station here, near Johns Hopkins, that would not even begin to pass the first stage of review. It's being located in this community not only because it's near transport, but because I think at the time they thought there would not be strong community opposition, and that community opposition has grown and grown, and the economics of it don't make sense, and the health angle has been established that it's very, very has the potential to greatly endanger the people that live in that area.
And there's a way in which economics and health overlap. I'm more familiar with it, a study on mercury pollution. But heavy metals, which affect IQ of children.
I mean, what are heavy metals, just for our listeners?
Well, lead, mercury, cadmium. You could go on and list them.
Yeah, but right.
But they tend to be neurotoxic. And what that means is it can affect cognitive, or as we consider, IQ ability. And when children are affected by something that lowers their IQ, it really affects the quality of their lives. And in economics, it affects their earning potential. So there was a study out of Mount Sinai on mercury pollution. But I just give it as an example. In this case, it was mostly from power plants. But incidentally, this plant will emit 240 pounds – is permitted to emit 240 pounds of mercury a year. And so they estimated that in this study – from Mount Sinai, that the cost of American anthropogenic, from humans, emissions for a cohort of kids born in 2000. They were going to lose somewhere between a half and $15 billion over a lifetime of earnings in the U.S. So the point I'm making is that, yes, these health consequences are also economic consequences to the people who are being exposed. And there's an environmental justice issue here with this community that's been asked to continuously take the brunt of waste emissions that come from other places.
So what are you waiting for in terms of the Department of Environment's ruling? What will it say one way or the other?
I believe, and correct me, Gwen, that it will say whether the permit is valid or not. And the question is, Energy Answers appears to want to move forward with this project and is trying to maintain an active permit that is not challenged. We know a lot of purchasers of the energy from Energy Answers, when they found out the amount of pollution, have dropped their contracts. So we know this is struggling financially. But we also know they are very determined to build this plant. And if MDE rules that their permit is valid, we can probably expect a challenge, and we can expect Energy Answers to move forward.
And so there's no indication from them when they're going to make this decision.
There's no. Maryland Department of Environment doesn't give us a deadline. They didn't say to us, we're going to have it. It's just rumor. And then every time there's a rumor, the deadline that we think is going to be it passes.
So what is it they have to decide about that? What is it they have to do?
They have to decide that this permit has been violated and it gets pulled.
Violating what?
Well, I mean, specifics are, for example, as I mentioned before, construction. When you start construction, the EPA has a ruling that it has to be continue within 18 months. You can't just do something and then stop. Because – and I think the reason – again, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the reason is, you know, environmental regulations – I mean, this is about air quality. They tend to improve with time. So, hey, if there weren't this, you could say, well, look, let me get the permit now, and I'll build it in 10 years. And if the regulations are more stringent, I'm in free because I've got an old permit that allows me to pollute. So you can't have people having permits that are old because they're by older standards.
So then what would the holdup be? Is this a complex thing they put in, the Energy Answers? Is it a complex document they had that takes – it takes a lot to kind of parse out to make a decision?
I don't think so. But again, that's not my area of expertise, but I think it's a fairly simple decision. But again, I think Energy Answers wants to maintain its permit, and for some reason MDE is not making a decision and not explaining itself publicly.
So what are the alternatives here to that plant? That's the question that I wanted to get into.
That plant is not needed for anyone. We don't need that plant. We don't need it for energy. We don't need it to get rid of waste. We don't need it for economic development in that community. Energy Answers wants it to make money. It's a private company, and its purpose is to make money. But no one needs that plant. That plant is heavily subsidized by the state of Maryland. By getting tax credits, by being, quote, clean energy, unquote, tier one under the renewable portfolio standard. So we're subsidizing energy we don't need from a very dirty source in a very populated area.
I mean, so again, let me go to what the alternatives are to this plant. And one of the things I'm understanding from the community, there are all kinds of ideas about, I mean, what to do to create jobs in that community. But also about the question of recycling. I mean, we do have this massive garbage, metal and other things that you have to get rid of. So what's the alternative?
Okay, so a few things. First of all, it would be interesting if we knew where that was coming from, because whose garbage is it, and why does it come here? But secondarily, there are reasons why incineration. Not only is it, you know, a bad way to make energy because it's more polluting than some of the other dirtiest energy sources. It's a bad plan in its own right, because the more you incinerate, the less you're going to recycle, reuse, and then you're going to have to remake it. We don't have a high rate of recycling in this area.
Yeah, you pointed out in your article, I think it was your article, you pointed that to the editor, where it's dropped considerably. Op-ed that our recycling efforts in Baltimore have diminished dramatically since 2011.
And when you have an incinerator, often what you have is a put or pay contract. So I know that was true. It's true with the medical waste incinerator. So, for example, if your company or hospital, again, that's medical waste, but in this case, if they were taking your waste and you had to pay a minimum, then there would be no incentive for you to recycle. You have to pay anyway. You might as well just put in the incinerator, give it to the company. They put it in the incinerator, up it goes in the stack. And when you do that, you have to you squander resources. Then you have to use resources to remake whatever it was that you just incinerated. I mean, we've gotten to be a throwaway society in a way. We use it. We don't like it. We throw it away and get a new one. We can't do that anymore. So what's the alternative? The alternative is working towards zero waste, and other communities have. I think San Francisco and other places have a much higher rate of recycling, and they really commit to policies that make it more possible to do that rather than this idea of we throw away what we don't use anymore.
So that's a big part of this issue. I mean, clearly that there is a problem with stuff with materials left behind, recycling not being what it was in Baltimore in terms of that industry. So there have to be alternatives. And so the question is, what are you proposing policy wise to say for the city to deal with while you're battling and waiting for the state to come up with this decision about what's going to happen with Energy Answers? What is the city supposed to be doing to make some changes here as well?
I would add a caveat there that I know some of the contracts in the city were pulled. In other words, we don't know that a lot of that waste is coming from Baltimore or Maryland. It could very well be coming from upstate New York, from New York City, from Trenton. This is waste that will be imported largely, we believe, from out of state.
And I'll give you an example that's sort of a little bit roundabout. So I was looking into, why is there going to be so much lead? Why 1,000 pounds? Where is it coming from? So a professor of mine at the School of Public Health sent me a very interesting article that there are weights in tires. You may know that. And a lot of times they're lead weights.
Right.
So the materials that you use are important. So lead weights should be outlawed. There shouldn't be lead weights in tires. They should be steel or, something else. But if we incinerate whatever they send us, hey, you can make it with the lead because we're going to get rid of it. Only somebody's going to breathe that stuff in when you vaporize it. So the materials that you use matter. And when you don't have landfills that you can fill up and incinerators that you can just send things to, then you have to be more thoughtful about the materials you start with.
I mean, but clearly, I'm curious what you both think about what the politics are here beyond the community. I mean, why is it that you think that the state, no matter whether it's a Democratic administration under O'Malley, Republican administration under Larry Hogan, or the mayor's office, is so reluctant to deal with this? I mean, what's your sense of why is it so hard to put our hands around this issue beyond your pay grade? But you're a physician, MPH. What do you mean by that?
I think people should know it makes no economic sense. It makes no sense in terms of health. It makes no sense in terms of energy. So you figure out, who's benefiting, but it doesn't seem to be our state.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. It's very hard to understand the politics. I think the politics of this occurs largely out of sight from the community.
Obviously,
which is part of the problem.
Nobody's giving an answer here.
Right.
But so what are your next steps in this before we?
Well, we've asked for a moratorium on lead-emitting facilities. This is separate from Energy Answers, but Energy Answers
is – Indianapolis, you've asked for this?
We've asked MDE, the Maryland Department of Environment, for a moratorium on facilities that emit lead in southern Baltimore and Curtis Bay. And one of the drivers behind that was Energy Answers. And as we looked at Energy Answers and we found that they were permitted to emit 1,000 pounds of lead – we began to try and understand what other facilities were emitting in southern Baltimore and Curtis Bay, and it was very difficult to find out. And it's very difficult to understand what sort of lead burdens are already in those communities. So we believe the appropriate thing for MDE to do, based purely on public health, would be to not allow any more facilities in these areas that emit lead into the environment until they come up with a monitoring plan with community input and a better understanding of what the burdens are in these communities. That being said, because of the sheer amount of lead being emitted from this facility as well as other toxic pollutants, you know, we will oppose the Energy Answers incinerator, you know, to the end. We just can't find a reason to justify it from a public health point of view.
Final thought on this, Gwen?
Well, I guess a couple things, and that is with incineration, because there are multiple pollutants, then the burden to the body is that much worse. So one of the things that's really bad is fine particulate matter, which this facility is permitted. I think it's 156 tons a year. But this fine particulate matter is like a vehicle to bring other pollutants into the body. So lead can adsorb or like hitch a ride on the fine particulate matter. And because it's so small, it gets into the body. You can inhale it, get deep into the lungs, and then get into the bloodstream and go from there. So it's the combination of pollutants that is even more toxic than looking at them as individual toxins. And nobody in terms of public health is really looking at that for this community. So or in this state. And the other thing I wanted to say is this community of people who oppose this incinerator have done a really great job at looking into other to connect with people who have opportunities for other sources of jobs. And I could go through the list of them, but 100 jobs, St. Vincent de Paul Auto and Furniture Repair Shop, a recycle manufacturing facility, an e-works plant, a composting operation. And then there's this idea about a solar energy array.
Right.
So there are really some exciting alternatives. But right now, that land is unusable. Because they're sitting, you know, because Energy Answers is sitting on a permit that MDE is allowing them to sit on.
I want to thank you both for being here. As we continue our look at what's happening in Curtis Bay with this incinerator and the alternatives the community is attempting to build. And you just heard Dr. Gwen DuBois, who is Secretary of the Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility, and an internist in private practice, and Tim Whitehouse, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Physicians for Social Responsibility. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to Soundbites right here on The Mark Steiner Show, and when we come back, we'll hear from a Salisbury teacher who is calling for better treatment of chickens on farms on the Eastern Shore. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Soundbites on The Mark Steiner Show, here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. Now we're about to have a conversation with Jane Langrell Robinson, who wrote an op-ed, a letter to the editor, to the Sun Papers, about chickens, something we talk a lot about here on The Mark Steiner Show and on Soundbites. And Jane is a middle school teacher and animal advocate who lives in Salisbury and joins us here now. And Jane, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show in Soundbites.
Thank you. Good to be there.
So talk a bit about, now why did you feel compelled to write this letter?
Well, I've lived with produced chickens and plants and chicken houses my entire life and really have not paid a whole lot of attention to them growing up. But I became involved with animal activism and advocacy about probably 4 or 5 years ago, fairly strongly on my off time.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much extra time I had during the school year, but mostly marine mammals and captivity issues and that type of thing. But the more I read and the more that I watched videos and talked to people that were in animal activism, a lot of them would say, well, you know, you have the Purdue and the chicken farms all around you. I said, I know, I've grown up with them, and I don't really know too much about the way they're treated. So I started to learn about it, and it's awful. So it was just one of those things that I guess when you're surrounded by the stuff, you just ignore it as a child, and it's sort of part of the culture here.
You grew up there. You grew up in
I've lived here my whole life except for 5 years. So, mm-hmm. And my whole life, that would be almost 60. So, my entire life. And I know the Purdue family, and I know the kids and the grandchildren, and my parents were friends with, you know, somebody older Purdue. But it just was a given that we're surrounded by it, but the more you do some research and, of course, the videos that you look at, and you can't go on the road here without being behind or in front of or beside one of those trucks as transport. So you kind of have that every day. It's every day, the everyday occurrence of them sending them to the factories, not just Purdue, but Tyson and the other plants that are nearby, because Tyson's up the road. But it's just one of those things where I just started to learn about it, and I became disgusted by it. And then a lot of other people around here have gotten me involved in some of the environmental problems with the farms, and we're worrying now about CAFOs here, the chicken factory farms. And it's becoming just something, I guess, that's just been bothering a lot of us. And especially the cruelty to the animals and also the cruelty to the workers. That can't be minimized either, because that's pretty bad. So it's just something that sort of evolved in me. The more I became involved with animals, I started to look at that, which was right under my nose.
One of the things that motivated you to write this piece was a film you saw, Mercy for Animals?
There was right. Mercy for Animals did an undercover video. And I saw it, I believe, on Facebook. I can't remember if it was Facebook or their website. And I was shocked. And I've seen lots of videos of animal slaughter and animal treatment. So it's not shocking to me to see how factory animals are treated. It's horrible. But I was just appalled by what I saw. And this was the recent one, I think, back in November, December. It's pretty recent. And I contacted Mercy for Animals, and I knew some people that had worked for them, and I said, I'm going to write a letter because I'm just so disgusted by it. And, you know, there are things that can be done. So I did a little bit of research and found out their practices, and what I saw was pretty standard, apparently, in the industry. And it's just something I felt I had to write about. So I did write the piece, and Baltimore Sun put it in their op-ed. They were very kind to me. I tried to get it into the local papers, but nobody wanted it.
Politically, it's probably hard to get it in the local papers.
Sure, it is. And, you know, everybody's friends and has to live with the industry here. And I understand that. But
as you wrote, I mean, in terms of Purdue, and they did kind of, because of all this, create a new position inside their company.
Right.
You wrote about chief animal welfare officer, family,
right.
Farm family advocate. I mean, they put that in there, right?
Yeah, exactly. They seem to be appalled as well, exactly. And they've created a new position, chief animal welfare officer. And I don't know if that's just talk, or if they really have started to produce some sort of plan for changing the care of these animals. This has been such a long-standing tradition, the way these animals are raised with their farmers, and I don't know how they plan on implementing the change, or if they do even plan on doing it, or if it's just lip service to us. But I'm hoping they do something, because the conditions are just horrible for these animals. And I'm also starting to read the conditions for the workers, and there's been a lot of new stories out about Purdue and some other, especially Purdue. Baltimore Sun had a recent article about the workers there, and I'm not concerned about the humans, but it was Oxfam that did that. But it's just a cruel industry all around, and it needs to be changed entirely, top to bottom. But it's a huge money-making industry here, and people are tied into it. A lot of growers, a lot of people that work for the Purdue plants and the main headquarters here.
So one of the things that we've experienced on the Eastern Shore over the last several months is a series of town meetings we've had in different communities on the Eastern Shore, both in Virginia and in Maryland, and talking to folks in Delaware as well, who are a little further east than you are in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been kind of organizing, not so much opposing Purdue as all these new gigantic CAFOs that are moving
absolutely
into the community.
Right. So, I've joined one of those groups on Facebook. I haven't really put much effort into helping them yet, except for reading some articles and contributing some things. And I know my friend Astig Kathy Phillips has included me in that group. And yeah, they're getting ready to hit us hard with those here, and people are very upset about it. So that's a work in progress, but I'm not sure what the county is thinking when they're agreeing to these big production farms, their factory farms, and near the water channel, and just a lot of residents that are going to be in the mix of this, and it's going to be awful. But yes, Somerset County's had a time in the Virginia and up in Delaware too. So it's, I think people are becoming aware of it. Apparently there's a lot of uproar here, and I'm going to try to start helping those folks on my off time, but it's coming.
and the biggest difference, it seems to me, about this is that most of the chickens, whether you agree or not with how they're done, raised by Purdue, who we're most familiar with, are raised by men and women who own farms.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're farmers, and that's how
right.
you make a living as a farmer in the 21st century, and they raise chickens.
Right.
But what's happening now, I'm understanding it further east, is that these large CAFOs being built with even more chickens than most farmers would raise are not even being raised by farmers.
Exactly.
They're being raised by companies who are just raising the chickens.
Right. And nobody that, yes, they're out of state or out of country. People that are buying up the property and they're not going to live there. They're not farmers, and they'll have someone managing it, of course, and people managing it. But they're not farmers. They're factory. It'll be a factory, and that's basically what they should be called, is factories. Besides the cruelty, and you have this whole environmental problem, which is going to be massive, and. Yeah, the cruelty is one side of it, which will be just, monumental in these places. But then you think about the water supply and the air, and it's going to be terrible. And if we let it happen and we let it continue, this whole beautiful area that we live in is just going to be destroyed. It's already bad enough with all of the chicken houses, but people are used to that, and it's the farmers that have lived here for a long time, and that's their industry, that's their livelihood, and we know those people. We don't know these people.
So,
not that I have to know them, but you know what I mean.
No, I understand.
They're strangers.
And they're not farmers,
and they don't care about the community.
So, what have you noticed any kind of trend among your friends, a change of attitude, thinking about with communities on shore and what's going on? I mean, what kind of conversations do you have with people, whether they're on the farm or in the town?
Well, I speak mostly to teachers.
Okay,
I'm with them all day long. Besides my children, and
I know how hard teachers work. Yes.
Well, we do talk a lot about food sources, and matter of fact, we talk about where they shop, and a lot of these people refuse to buy. And I don't eat animals, so I don't shop for animals. But a lot of them refuse to buy mass-produced farm products. They either know local farmers that they go to, that they can see the animals, or try to get humanely raised, meats. But they're concerned about the pollution. People are really concerned about the pollution here, I think more so than the animal cruelty. People are concerned about the environment. And I know my students are as well, but I think a lot of the folks here are just very concerned about the road we're taking with these big farms and what it can lead to and the way of life. And I know one person that sort of moved away. A friend said, I'm going to move over to the beach because I just don't want to be around, local government that's going to let this happen. So, that's one person. That's not really a scientific study. But it's, the people that I talk to are concerned about the environment. I'm concerned about the animals and the environment, and then, I'm finding out about the people aspect of it. But I don't think people are satisfied anymore with the way the farming is going with the chicken farming. I don't think they are. I think people are starting to become aware, which is good.
So, I mean, given your history, living on the shore, growing up on the shore, growing up around Salisbury, how do you respond to farmers and other people on the shore who say they'd have nothing if Purdue made a decision to leave because they're being pushed around about better treatment, more regulation, stopping factory farms, CAFOs being built? I mean, so how do you respond to that?
Well, I think farmers can still farm. It just has to be other things put into place so that policies are enacted, and the chicken farms themselves have to be redesigned. Of course, who's going to do that? That's awfully expensive. But I never want to see anyone lose a job or have to move away. And I don't think I don't think people are going to lose their jobs. I just think people need to be aware of good farming practices. And the farming community, the chicken industry, sort of regulates itself, from what I understand. And I'm not as knowledgeable about it as a lot of people are. But I don't know what the answer is. I'm not smart enough to know the answer.
Well, no, you're smarter, but it's not an easy answer.
No, it isn't, because the people that I know that are farmers or that even work for Purdue in the offices, they're good, they're great people. I've gone to school with them and gone to college with them, and they're great people. But I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how we can all live together and the environment can survive and people's jobs can survive and chickens can be treated better. I don't know what the answer is to. I don't think the big factory farms are the answer. I think that will kill us. I think that will just really ruin our quality of life here.
So coming back to what originally motivated you to write the letter, which had to do with the way animals are treated, this world we live in where people demand cheap meat.
Right.
And I've visited Purdue Farms and, with the folks from the company and bringing me to certain farmers and walking through the houses. And, the first thing you notice is you are kind of overwhelmed by the stench of ammonia.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Inside of chicken houses.
I've been in chicken houses. It's been a long time, but I did in, back in the 80s. That's a long, long time ago, or late 70s. And it is awful. It's just awful.
But then again, the inexpensive meat is part of what's going on here. People want chicken on their plates,
right?
And that's what people buy. Most people buy in the stores. Since you were motivated to write this letter? I mean, what is it you know, or have observed, or learned before and since about the treatment of animals when they're being raised, and also when they're being plucked out of the houses to be taken to slaughter?
Well, the whole system is cruel. I mean, I would prefer people don't eat animals, but nobody.
Do you eat meat?
No.
You don't? Okay.
No, I don't. So I'm
an omnivore, so I'll just be clear. So
well, I'm looking at it, and I'm not a vegan. I'm 99% there, but to me, it's just awful. But I hope people could do with less meat, but that's not going to. As a matter of fact, I did not include that in the letter. A couple of people said, well, you need to just tell people not to eat meat. I said, well, that's a whole different issue because this isn't about – I'm not going to convince people not to eat meat. I'm talking about the way that if they're going to eat meat, the chickens need to be treated better and they need to have better lives. And it's really – when you see them on the truck, it is awful to look at them. They are filthy. I mean, it's just – and I think, how do people even want to eat that? I mean, because – besides the fact that I wouldn't want to eat them because they're living creatures, but how do people even want to eat that? So I don't know. I don't know. I just was horrified by the treatment. I was horrified by what I learned about the industry, how it's been so long, in the same way. And there have been as many complaints years ago about the cruelty, and it doesn't seem like anything has changed. Even their own farmers. Mr. Watts down in North Carolina, who talked about it and just had it with, and he's a farmer, one of their farmers, and he just was demonized over it. He just couldn't live with it any longer. So I don't really know what the answer is. I'm just going to try to get people's attention so that they know it and are aware of it and can maybe make some different choices. But there's a lot of other people that do a much better job of it than I do. I just try to let people know. I do that all the time at school. I let people know they have animals all the time. They go, oh, gosh, here comes the orca girl.
I'm just curious about you, what you just pick up, what you just said, you and your neighbors and people around you, in the response to this letter. What was the response to your letter from either
to
folks?
My letter? To
yeah.
My letter?
Yeah, yeah.
I got some really nice emails, mostly from people on the Western Shore.
Mm-hmm.
but my friends that read it here were really tickled about it, and some people shared it. And, people, I guess I feel like I'm in the minority here a lot. There are these like-minded folks that we just talked about with the groups against the factory farms, but it's mostly meat eaters here, and mostly people that just hunters, fishermen, and that type of thing, and they're nice people. I guess I got that's great. I didn't know. I did have several people say to me, "Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea that's what happened. I've never been in a chicken house, and I've never known that that's how they raise them so quickly, and they get so big, and they can't stand up, and they have heart attacks." And I said, "Yeah, this is," and they were kind of, "Oh, I guess I should really do some research about, where I buy my chickens and what happens to them and, how they're raised." I said, well, that would be great if you could do that. but I just think people are so used to this industry here that they just turn a blind eye to it.
See, because I think that sometimes the industry or the people around political figures act like people who oppose Purdue or question mm-hmm. things, critical of treatment or the operations, people like you, that are kind of planted there by environmental organizations to disrupt stuff.
Right.
And not that you or others are kind of beginning to come to kind of questions yourself to kind of question things. I mean, there's a real disconnect there for many people.
Right. And, animal activists are sort of, people think, well, you're nuts or you're, what's wrong with you? But really, I think a lot of us are in the right and we just want better treatment. But yes, they and you're looked at as if you're sort of disloyal. The chicken industry's done so much for the shore and it has. And the Purdue family is very philanthropic and
they've
done a tremendous amount here. I think they can do better though. They've got the money and they have the power and they can change some things, but I don't know that they're interested in it because it's worked so well for so long. But, I'm not a plant. I've lived here a long time. I'm in my disguise. I'm a 60th year.
Posing as a simple middle school teacher.
Right, as an English teacher of eighth graders. Boy, I could have picked something a little bit easier to do.
Eighth grade English is not an easy thing to do. I admire that. So I this is fascinating. I think both the political aspect of this that you that you raise. And I kind of like to leave us with some thoughts just about what you want people to understand, why you wrote the letter, how you came to this place for yourself to be an advocate for animals.
Well, I really think if people want to find out the information about their food, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to find out how your food is raised and how it's treated, animals, and of course, same thing goes for veggies and, you know, organic things. The information is out there if you're interested, and then you can make a choice about whether you want to buy a product that's raised inhumanely, or if you would rather find something that's different. Of course, it's going to be more expensive, but I'm not sure what the chicken prices are now for. But I don't think any of it's cheap, really. But people just need to be aware of how other living creatures are treated, and they can make choices. And you can the information is out there to find about anything. I just sort of got into this. I mostly ignored the problem until a couple years ago, chickens. And then once I started reading this stuff, it's just there. It's there for everybody to see and to read. And you can certainly choose with your pocketbook things that are better for you and better for the environment and better for, better for you health-wise. So it's easy to do if you have the gumption to do it.
This has been a really interesting conversation, and when I read your letter, I knew I wanted to talk to you and learn more about what you were thinking and how you got to where you are.
I'd like to get a little bit more involved in the, like we talked about. I've just started learning about the factory farmings here, and I'm hoping I can help the organizations that are working on that, because they're really doing a good job, the regular people. And I'd like to also find out more about the workers, because that's just another, as an animal activist, I first started looking at that, and I do care about people or I wouldn't be teaching. But I really want to find out more about this and see how I can maybe assist some local organizations in that. So I'll do a little more homework. Like I say, I'm a little new to this.
Well, Jane Langrell Robinson, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate the letter you wrote to the Sun protecting Purdue's chickens. We will attach this letter to our website at steinershow.org and soundbitesradio.org as well. Jane Langrell Robinson is the middle school teacher and animal advocate who grew up and lived in Salisbury, Maryland, who wrote this piece for the Sun and joined us here today on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Jane, thank you so much for being part of our show.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Public Radio is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, Calvin Perry, and Morgan Barber. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also learn more about Soundbites and listen to past episodes at soundbitesradio.org. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.